Hello and welcome back to the October edition of the Astropod. I'm Quinton Goddard.
And I'm Anna Quiter.
So Anna, how was your holiday?
It was great. Got a lot of research done.
Fantastic. More productive than mine then. So what's coming up this month?
Well, so this month marks the beginning of the public observing here at the Institute of Astronomy. Come out on Wednesday, October 8th at 7:15 for a lecture by Robin Catchpole entitled, Are We Alone? You should particularly bring the youngsters with you because this lecture is family-friendly. If it's clear, observing will start at 8 p.m.
Well, that does sound fascinating, Anna, but I think I can trump that with Impact Day, which is a day exploring the world of meteorites and comets. That's on Sunday, the 12th of October, from 10 a.m. Admission is free, and it's right here at the IOA in Cambridge. And there are talks from people like Peter Ingram, who's an experienced lecturer and broadcaster, as well as many children's activities. So do bring along the whole family.
That sounds great. So, Quincy, I've been hearing a lot about the Large Hadron Collider.
Well, yes, here at the Astropod, we're very excited about this new physics experiment. And despite it being built by particle physicists, it's really a cosmology tool, hoping to find out what the universe was like just after the Big Bang, and trying to unlock the deep secrets of the universe. Unfortunately, though, we've managed to break it already after quenching one of the magnets.
What does quenching mean?
Well, Anna, the Large Hadron Collider uses these massive superconducting magnets. Now, a superconductor is a piece of metal that has no resistance when you cool it down. Now, the magnets they use in the Large Hadron Collider have to be cooled down to extremely low temperatures using liquid helium. But unfortunately, if something goes wrong with one of these magnets, it might begin to heat up. And as soon as it does, it gets some resistance and gets very hot very quickly. And when you combine something that's getting hot quickly with liquid helium, you turn your liquid helium into gas and things go very wrong very quickly. And that's what's called a quench. And unfortunately, that happened with one of the supermagnets and it's damaged some of the apparatus, which is going to take a while to repair. We hope it's going to be back up and running by springtime next year.
I'll keep an eye out for that then.
Well, we look forward to seeing some of the fascinating results from the Large Hadron Collider, but not for a few months yet. So let's find out what else has been going on in the world of astronomy and astrophysics. Over to you, Laura.
Hello, I'm Laura Churcher with this month's Astro News. Image of a planet around a sun-like star. A trio of astronomers from the University of Toronto has taken a picture of a planetary mass candidate next to a young star that has roughly the Sun's mass. To see it, last April they utilised an adaptive optics-aided infrared imager attached to the Gemini North telescope atop Mauna Kea in Hawaii. However, there's no information yet on the characteristics of its orbit, or indeed whether it's even bound to the star at all. They do know that it's not a star because it's not very hot, about 1,800 kelvins or 1,500 degrees C, and its infrared spectrum reveals the presence of water and carbon monoxide. Most likely it's about 8 times the mass of Jupiter. The parent star lies at about 500 light-years from Earth. The two objects are separated by about 300 astronomical units. For comparison, Pluto is at about 30 AU from the Sun. That's already raised eyebrows among solar system modellers because it's highly unlikely that so massive a planet could have formed so far from its star. Discoverer Ray Jayawardena admits that calling it a planet is a stretch. More likely, it's a failed binary star with a seriously stunted secondary. However, he notes that a massive planet might conceivably have formed closer in and then been tossed outward by a chance encounter with another large planet soon after the young star formed. Hubble astronomers baffled by a mystery object. Don't get the idea that we have found every kind of astronomical object there is in the universe. Astronomers working on the Supernova Cosmology Project report finding a new kind of something that they cannot make any sense of. The project used the Hubble Space Telescope to monitor very distant galaxy clusters for supernovae. On February 21, 2006, in the direction of a faraway cluster in Bootes, Hubble began seeing something brighten. It continued brightening for about 100 days and peaked at 21st magnitude in two near-infrared colours. It then faded away over a similar timescale until nothing was left in view down to 26th magnitude. The object brightened and faded by a factor of at least 120, maybe more. The mystery object did not behave like any known kind of supernova. It is not even in any detectable galaxy. The shape of the light curve is inconsistent with microlensing, say the researchers. They recorded three spectra of it, and its spectrum, they write, in addition to being inconsistent with all known supernovae types, is not matched to any spectrum in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey database of a vast number of objects. We suggest that the transient may be one of a new class. Haumea, a new dwarf planet, is named. On September 17th, the International Astronomical Union announced that another object in the Kuiper Belt is large enough to qualify as a dwarf planet, the fifth to be named. It will be called Haumea, after the goddess of childbirth and fertility in Hawaiian mythology. The name was suggested by Michael Brown and colleagues at Caltech, who spotted the object on December 28, 2004. Brown's team proposed not only Haumea, but also Hiaka and Namaka, two of Haumea's many children, for the two moons. The shape of Haumea, formerly named 2003 EL61, is roughly 1,960 by 1,000 kilometres, giving it the appearance of a fast-rotating squashed rugby ball. That's all for this month's news. For more information, please check out the Cargo Bay area of our website.
Thanks for that fascinating news, Laura. Now it's time for a new section of the Astropod. I'm going to hand over to Anna, who's going to tell us about the history of astronomy.
Since this month's interview is about the new Planck satellite, we thought it'd be interesting to explain who Planck was. Max Planck was a German theoretical physicist who lived from 1858 to 1947. Despite being a gifted young musician, he decided to study physics at the University of Munich, and we're really glad that he did. He received the 1918 Nobel Prize in Physics for his work on quantum mechanics, which is the set of physical rules that govern atoms and other very small things. He is most famous for proving that on small scales, energy exists in discrete units known as quanta. Although the idea of energy existing as individual packets troubled him, he persisted with this notion and eventually arrived at Planck's law. Planck's law explains how the intensity of light given off by an object changes with the temperature of the object. This is why a piece of metal goes from being red-hot to white-hot as it is heated. This principle is very important for studying stars and the Big Bang, which are two examples of things that follow Planck's law. Today, we see the Big Bang's radiation as the cosmic microwave background. This is what the Planck satellite will be observing, so it's over to you, Quincy, with the interview.
Hello and welcome to the interview section of the Astropod. This month I'm speaking with Anthony Challoner about the up-and-coming new satellite Planck. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Hi there.
So today we're talking about the new Planck satellite. Let's give people sort of an introduction. What exactly is Planck?
Okay, so Planck is the third generation of satellite experiments, which is trying to measure variations in the temperature of the cosmic microwave background radiation. So this is essentially the oldest light in the universe, and we believe it's a remnant of the hot Big Bang about 13 billion years ago. And since that time, that radiation has really just cooled down as the universe has expanded, and we see it today as radiation with a temperature of about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. It has a very uniform temperature all across the sky, but there are tiny fluctuations in the temperature, and they're at the level of about one part in 100,000. So what Planck is trying to do is build on earlier work, in particular work done by the COBE satellite and also more recently by the WMAP satellite, to try and map these tiny variations in the temperature and hence learn something about the way matter is distributed in the universe and also the sort of conditions that were prevalent in the early universe.
So we're really looking back to the very earliest light that we found in the universe.
That's right. Essentially, the great thing about the microwave background, it gives us a snapshot of what conditions looked like very shortly after the Big Bang.
So Planck is going to be measuring the temperature of this cosmic microwave background. How exactly does it do that?
Okay, well, Planck is actually two instruments, a high-frequency instrument and a low-frequency instrument. And the technology is rather different between the two instruments. So the low-frequency instrument is essentially radio technology. So it amplifies a signal and makes a coherent detection of it. Whereas the high-frequency instrument, which is somewhat more sensitive, uses what are called bolometers. So essentially, these are semiconductive devices which absorb the power of the incident radiation, and then they heat up a little solid-state thermometer, and that's how we measure the temperature.
So it's essentially sort of a telescope thermometer almost.
That's right, yeah. So the two instruments, the high-frequency and low-frequency instrument, they have a common telescope, which has a sort of 1.5-metre diameter primary mirror. The two instruments are sitting at the focus of that mirror.
So how accurately are we actually able to measure the temperature of the cosmic microwave background with Planck?
Well, that's the amazing thing. So as I said, the temperature on average is about 2.7 Kelvin above, 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. And the fluctuations that we're trying to measure are about 1/100,000th of that. And Planck is sufficiently sensitive to make a very high signal-to-noise measurement of those fluctuations over the full sky. So, for example, to compare it to its predecessor, the WMAP satellite, it's basically an order of magnitude more sensitive.
So it's getting some 10 times better than the WMAP.
That's right, yeah.
So when does Planck actually go up into the sky and launch?
Okay, well, so the latest plan is it will be launched in early 2009. The satellite has undergone a series of testing very, very recently, because it's been going very well. So yes, the plan is to launch early 2009 from Kourou.
So I think people often underestimate just how much effort and planning goes into building a satellite like this. Just how long have people been thinking about the Planck satellite and designing it?
Well, Planck is now around 15 years in the making.
There's really a long lead-up time to getting...
That's right, yeah.
A satellite with this complexity up into the sky.
That's absolutely right, yeah. And the thing that actually makes Planck particularly complex is the fact that to get high sensitivity, it has to be very, very cold. And the high-frequency instrument is actually cooled to just 0.1 degrees above absolute zero, the detectors in it. And technology like that, as it's really the first time it will have been flown in space, which is why Planck has had such a long lead time.
So you mentioned just how cold it has to keep itself up in space. How does it actually maintain such a low temperature?
It has a complicated series of what are essentially fridges, where one fridge cools the whole units down to a certain temperature, and then another fridge takes over and cools it even lower. And the high frequency instrument has three such stages to get down to its lowest required temperature.
So yeah, previously you mentioned the Kobe satellite and the WMAP satellite, the sort of two predecessors to Planck, which have both done fantastic work. And I think it was the Kobe satellite which won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago for its work on the cosmic microwave background. So what new science are we actually going to get out of Planck?
Okay, so, I mean, as I mentioned, the main advance over WMAP is the higher sensitivity, but also the angular resolution is somewhat better. It's about three times better. So it can basically measure things that are about 1/3 of the size on the sky that WMAP was able to. So the sort of primary things we want to do with Planck are basically to learn something about the physics that that drove the early universe. So, for example, there are a very popular theory called the inflationary theory, which there are strong hints for in data from the WMAP satellite, for example. But we should be able to test that sort of theory much more accurately with Planck, essentially by looking at the distribution of temperature fluctuations with scale on the sky. And we can try and sort of map out how that relates back to what the fluctuations in the early universe itself were looking like.
So we're really beginning to sort of able to rule out theories about how the universe formed and has developed since its creation.
That's absolutely right, yeah.
So any other sort of interesting theories or any other bits of information we might be able to get out from the Planck satellite data?
Okay, I mean, the one really perhaps exciting thing to look out for is that there's a chance that Planck might be able to detect a background of gravitational waves, which are also a byproduct of inflation theory. So gravitational waves have never been detected, but there's quite an industry now to try and detect astrophysically produced gravitational waves. So, for example, from systems with sort of binary systems.
Sort of two neutron stars.
Two neutron stars, for example, yeah. But the sort of waves that Planck would be sensitive to are much, much longer wavelength. They're sort of cosmologically, wavelengths of cosmological scales. But as I said, these are expected to be produced in the early universe, and that would give us a lot of very important information about what conditions were like then, and in particular, essentially, how fast the universe was expanding at the time that inflation occurred. So the sort of most simplest models of inflation predict a level of gravitational waves that Planck will be able to, should be able to observe. So that's a very exciting thing, which we're very hopeful for, that we'll get something very interesting.
So we're really able to sort of pin down the fundamental characteristics of the universe we're living in with this satellite.
That's absolutely right, yeah. So interested in both the sort of early universe, but we'll also learn things about the late time universe. Very broad questions like what is the universe made of, how much matter is there, how much dark matter is there, so the sort of stuff that's holding galaxies together. And we'll also learn things of astrophysical interest as well. When we look at the microwave sky, we don't just see the cosmic microwave background, but we see emission from our own galaxy. And one advance that Planck has over previous satellites is that it has a much wider coverage in terms of frequency. So we'll learn an awful lot about the high-frequency galactic emission as well.
So obviously it's a massive project involving several institutions. What exactly are we working on here at the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge?
Okay, so in Cambridge we've been involved with the data side. So of course we don't have any data yet, so we've been doing preparatory work so far. And essentially what we're responsible for is what is called the Level 3 data processing. So this is effectively taking all the maps of the sky that Planck will produce and trying to sort them out so that we can extract both the cosmic microwave background and also the various galactic emissions that will also be present in that data. So ultimately what we want to produce is a map of the cosmic microwave background and then a map of various components of galactic emission, such as what's called synchrotron emission, from electrons spiraling in the galactic magnetic field, emission from dust within our galaxy, and also a catalogue of what compact sources. So these are sort of extragalactic objects and clusters of galaxies. And the like.
So really being able to distinguish between sort of the foreground emission and what is the background.
That's absolutely
cosmic
right.
Microwave background emission.
That's correct.
Great. So any final remarks about the Planck satellite?
Just watch this space, really. It will be a very exciting time. We're all very excited about the launch. It's been a long time coming, but it's getting very near now. It's a very complicated experiment, but hopefully all will work once it's up in space. And it should be very exciting indeed.
Well, 15 years in the planning. We hope it brings back some fantastic results. And I think the rest of the science community is really looking forward to seeing what we find out. Thanks very much for coming on the show, Anthony. It's been great.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the interview, Quincy. So now it's time for us to answer your questions.
Our first question is for you, Anna. What exactly is a space elevator?
Well, Quincy, a space elevator is a non-rocket-based way to transport people and cargo from the Earth into space. This idea has been around since the 1950s, but it's only recently that technological advances have begun to make it possible. The main components of a space elevator are a docking platform on the Earth, a 36,000-kilometer-long cable, a counterweight set in orbit around the Earth, and a platform that travels up and down the cable. The main challenge is the cable, which needs to be 180 times stronger than steel. Recent work done here at Cambridge on carbon nanotubes has made making such a cable more realistic. The Japan Space Elevator Association has recently announced a £5 billion investment in space elevator technology. Ultimately, a space elevator would use 100 times less energy than traditional rockets for getting into space. So sign up right now for your first ride on a space elevator. Our next question is, where does space begin?
Well, there's no sort of one answer to this question, Anna. You see, the Earth's atmosphere gets thinner the further you get away from the Earth's surface. And in fact, we can still find traces of oxygen molecules 160 kilometers above the Earth's surface. So there's no one answer to this question. Now, NASA defines being an astronaut as someone who's flown above 50 miles above the Earth's surface, which is about 80 kilometers for those who are using metric units. Now, just to put this in context, a passenger jet only flies at about 9 kilometers above the Earth's surface. And in fact, the International Space Station, which is flying 350 kilometers above the Earth's surface, still feels the effects of the Earth's atmosphere, and as it drags through the atmosphere, it gets pulled down close towards the Earth, and so several times a year, it has to fire its rockets to push it back up higher.
If you have a question for us, send an email to astropod@ast.cam.ac.uk Or you can visit us at one of the public observing nights starting Wednesday, October 8th at 7:15 at the Cambridge Institute of Astronomy.
And now it's time for jokes so bad they wouldn't even make it into your Christmas cracker. That's right, it's the Astronomy Joke of the Month. Over to you, Jane and Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
Hey, Jane.
Do you have a joke for me?
Why, yes, I do. Drum roll, please. What did the astronaut have for lunch?
I don't know. What did the astronaut have for lunch?
An unidentified flying object.
That's all we've got time for this month. We hope you've enjoyed the Astropod.
Thanks for listening.